On this 11th day of October, 2011, in San Diego, we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We are in Chapter 4, Transcendental Knowledge, text number 36. Apiched asi papebhya.
Apiched asi papebhya.
Sarvebhya papakritamaha.
Sarvebhya papakritamaha.
Sarvam jnana plavenaiva. Vrijinam santarishyasi. Translation. Even if you are considered to be the most sinful of all sinners, when you are situated in the boat of transcendental knowledge, you will be able to cross over the ocean of miseries. Purport. Proper understanding of one's constitutional position in relationship to Krishna is so nice that it can at once lift one from the struggle for existence which goes on in the ocean of nescience. This material world is sometimes regarded as an ocean of nescience and sometimes as a blazing forest. In the ocean, however expert a swimmer one may be, the struggle for existence is very severe. If someone comes forward and lifts the struggling swimmer from the ocean, he is the greatest savior. Perfect knowledge received from the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the path of liberation. The boat of Krishna consciousness is very simple, but at the same time, the most sublime. Om jnana timarandasya jnanandana shalakaya chakshu unmiditam mena tasmai shri gurave namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master opened my eyes with the torch of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. So, now we start with a couple of verses comparing knowledge to a boat and then to fire. In both cases, in relationship to one's sinful reactions. We are flailing around in the ocean of birth and death due to our sinful reactions. In the broadest sense, sin is any activity which is outside the realm of devotional service. So everyone's sinning, more or less. Now, there's degrees of sin. Grievous sins, just like in the civil society, a first-degree murder is punished by, you know, sometimes hanging or, you know, what is it, lethal injection or whatever. Whereas manslaughter won't be punished as much, robbery, you know, shoplifting. So there's degrees of, just like there's degrees of crime, there's degrees of sin. But all of it is illegal. All is any of these crimes, even civil, you know, crimes, are outside the realm of what is considered to be a good citizen. So similarly, we are in this world due to unlimited series of reactions due to activities we've done in the past outside the realm of devotional service. So the only way to be pardoned, if you will, you know, there's two ways of getting rid of the sins, or three ways. One is to let they burn out. You suffer a sinful reaction, and that particular sin is now paid for, as it were, like you paid your dues, you know, you serve your term or whatever. Another way is through atonement. This is explained in the sixth canto. Atonement means that you perform some austerity according to Vedic instructions to counteract the result of a sin. That can be done. But the problem with that, as explained very graphically in the sixth canto, is that you don't uproot the desire to perform the sin again. That's one of the results of sin. When you act in such a way, suppose you gamble, right? Gambling is said to be addictive. Well, every sense gratification is addictive, but gambling can be very addictive, just like a drug. So you gamble. The gambling itself will produce a bad reaction. Sometimes you can see it in this very life. Someone goes broke, he loses his family, loses his house. You know, he could have been an upstanding member of the community, but he gets into this gambling thing, and before you know it, he ruins his life in that way. And so that's called a mature sinful reaction. Now, sometimes you gamble, and you lose a little bit, you win a little bit, and you break even, right? So the sinful reaction of losing all your money hasn't manifested. But when you gamble, you plant the seed to do it again. This is called the kuta. You have these react the kuta, the bija, the aprarabdha karma, and the prarabdha karma reaction. Four things. So the bija, the seed, is the seed of the sinful reaction that's planted. The kuta is the tendency to do it again. Right? The aprarabdha karma is the not yet manifest result. You know? And the prarabdha karma is the, you see, you know, the person is suffering somehow. So you may not see when you do something, just like if you contract a disease, you know, nothing happens right away. But it's developing, and eventually it manifests and you suffer. You got to go to the hospital or do something radical. So all of these different stages of sinful reaction are within us in the subtle realm. You know, they're also being overseen by higher forces, you know, giving us our just desserts just at the right time. It's a very, very complicated thing. People have an accident out here on I-5 or something. There's a pileup. All right, there's five cars. Someone is injured, someone is killed, someone just gets a fender bender, this and that. So that means all of these sinful reactions are fructifying at various levels for all of these different people at that one time. Who can, you know, and it's happening all over the place. Who can keep track of that? Only the super soul. You know, it's so complicated. It's extremely complicated. And on the other side is also good reactions, good karma also being given. Someone, you know, just missed the accident. That was their luck. They did some pious thing in four births back or something. You can see how complicated it can get. So all of this, the papa means sin. Sinners, papabia are sinners, papa is sin. And the constant thing is going on all the time. And there's no real way to counteract it by the atonement process. You can try stopping, you know, the activity, and that's possible. Gamblers Anonymous or this, you know, rehab somewhere, you know. But the desire is still there, right? And that sinful reaction is also ready to fructify. Maybe it'll be postponed some years or some lifetimes. So the idea is that we have, all of us, you know, especially in this Kali Yuga, we all have this big load of karma that is just riding with us. And, you know, you don't know what it is. You know, why did this happen to me all of a sudden? Well, it came due, you know. So now, the present verse is saying that this is like an ocean, you know, an ocean in a storm, an ocean of birth and death. And in that ocean of birth and death is all this suffering, and the suffering is coming from sin. But even if you're the greatest sinner and you've got this big load of karma ready to come due, if you can get onto the boat of knowledge, and we'll discuss what that knowledge is, you can cross over it. In other words, you can get free of all of your sinful reactions and ply smoothly across the ocean of birth and death and go back home, back to God. So this is not ordinary knowledge. This is obviously not just book knowledge. It's not something you learn in college or high school, you know, or on your own. This knowledge is the knowledge spoken of in the previous verse 34. Upadekshanti te gyanam gyanana sattva darshana. This is given by one who has seen the real truth. In other words, a spiritual master. This is transcendental knowledge. And if we want to know what real knowledge consists of, we can turn to chapter 13, if you would indulge me. Text 8 to 11, I think it is. 8 to 12. And there are, I think, 20 items here in these five verses. Humility, pridelessness, nonviolence, tolerance, simplicity, approaching a bona fide spiritual master, cleanliness, steadiness, self-control, renunciation of the absence of sense gratification, absence of false ego. It's text 13:8. Yeah? Absence of false ego, the perception of the evil of birth, death, old age, and disease, detachment, freedom from entanglement with children, wife, home, and the rest, even-mindedness amid pleasant and unpleasant events, constant and unalloyed devotion to me. That's one of the elements of knowledge. Aspiring to live in a solitary place, detachment from the general mass of people, accepting the importance of self-realization, and philosophical search for the absolute truth, all these I declare to be knowledge And besides this, whatever there may be is ignorance. So this is the kind of knowledge that we need to be fixed in. You can see all the elements of it. To be on that boat. Basically, it means being a devotee of Krishna. And that will negate. The wonderful thing about it is, now in the sixth canto, you know, this is the famous story of Ajamil. Who here has heard of Ajamil? You know the story of Ajamil. So Ajamil was a sinner. You know, he was a heavy-duty sinner all his life, except for the first part, when he had been a Brahmin. He fell away from that platform, and he fell down into, you know, grievous sin, living with a prostitute, thieving, you know, carousing, everything. But he had the presence of mind to name his sons after names of God. So at the time of death, when he's being dragged out of his body to go to Yamaraj, where he gets his just deserts, that's with one S, what you deserve, meted out by Yamaraj, the judge, you know, according to his sins, he was completely saved, completely purified by the chanting of the holy name, even once in a helpless state like that. So how does that work? Well, that's like a special dispensation. Every morning we're singing the Shikshastika here, and Krishna says, Krishna, the former Lord Chaitanya, Nam Nam Akadi Bahudani Jasarva Shaktis Tatrapita. He's saying to Krishna, you have unlimited names, and in those names you have invested all your potencies. And there's no restriction. Anyone, anytime, any place can chant those names. You can't do that with some Rig Veda mantra. We're not even qualified to chant them. And even if we became qualified, it'd have to be a certain place, certain time. You know, you have to bathe ahead of time, face in the right direction. Who could even think about that? But Hare Krishna, it's pure spirit. And it's completely open to everyone. So the holy name has a special potency of purification. Purification. And even once chanting like that, you get free of all these sinful reactions. Now, Ajamil still had work to do because he still had some tendency toward materialism. He wasn't completely pure by that one chanting. But he had eliminated eons worth of sin. And so he wasn't eligible to be punished by Yamaraj anymore. And he saw everything. He realized the importance of bhakti. Then he went off to the Himalayas and finished the business, and then went back to Gaya. So, this process of bhakti, centering on the holy name, naturally produces gyan, naturally produces knowledge and detachment, and we can experience that. This is explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojitaha Janayati. Ashu vairagyam jnanam chayira hoitukam. It's a wonderful statement. By engaging in devotional service to Vasudeva, chanting his holy name, doing all these things, studying the Shastra under the guidance of his pure soul, then what happens? Quickly one develops knowledge and detachment. And then one gets on the boat. One's on that boat, crossing over the ocean. This is what this verse is all about. So, this is a great inducement. If we study, you know, even just through our life experience, what it means to be in this world, and what it means to be beset at every moment by troubles and anxieties and danger and fear, you know, then we should have the great impetus to get out of it, to get out of the boat and go across the ocean. Liberation. We don't want some dry liberation. We don't want to merge anywhere. We want to be liberated at the lotus feet of Krishna. That's also, you know, the word mukti. Mukti means liberation. There's a nice story about a verse in the Bhagavatam. Lord Chaitanya, he had many devotees in Puri, chief of whom was, say, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, you know, a resident there. And the second resident of Puri, who was a devotee, was the king himself, King Prataparudra. You know, imagine if the president or king became a full-fledged devotee of Krishna. How wonderful that would be. So this king, now because Lord Chaitanya was a sannyasi, he wouldn't see the king generally, you know. He had this devotee named Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. So Sarvabhauma was more or less an impersonalist at first, before he was converted by Lord Chaitanya himself. a conversation they had, Lord Chaitanya explained the Vedanta Sutra to him. The Vedanta Sutra is the main book of the Mayavadis. They have their commentation by Shankaracharya. So Lord Chaitanya gave the actual purport of the Vedanta, which is bhakti, and Sarvabhauma was converted. He was convinced. So then, later on, Lord Chaitanya was speaking to him, or I forget how the verse came up, forgive me, but there's a very famous verse by Lord Brahma, which is, the general gist is, that a real devotee is always looking for the mercy of the Lord, and expects the mercy, and sees everything as the mercy of Krishna. And whatever bad things happen, and they always do in our life, eventually, he sees it as a result, as I was just explaining, of his own previous activity. Atmakritam vipakam. Vipakam means bad stuff. Atmakritam, I did it myself. That's literally what it means. And at the same time, ridvagvapubi vridadan namaste. He still continues offering obeisances and service with his heart, with his words, and with his senses. In other words, sincerely. Then such a person, jivetayo mukti padesa dayabak. Dayabak means he practically inherits. He buys a ticket. He becomes deserving of this position called mukti pade. Pade means can mean lotus feet or can just mean a position. So he becomes worthy of the position of mukti. This is how Sarvabhauma read it. But he didn't even want to hear the word mukti anymore. So he changed the verse. Instead of mukti pade, he says bhakti pade. And Lord Chaitanya, who knew the verse, he said, you can't do that. You can't change the Bhagavatam just on your own whim. Every syllable is, you know, essential. So I was, I can't even hear mukti anymore. You know, he was a mukti body. He was a mayavadi. He was a personalist. Now he didn't even want to hear mukti. It just had a bad connotation for him. It brought back all the memories of trying to merge. It's just horrible, you know. So Lord Chaitanya laughed and he says, no, you know, mukti pade simply means a liberated position at the lotus feet of Krishna. There's nothing wrong with mukti if you know what mukti means. This morning, I think it was, we read in the purport, muktir hitvanyata rupam swarupena bivastiti. Or maybe it was yesterday's purport. Yeah, it was yesterday's purport. Here it is right here. Yeah, it's yesterday's verse. You can see it. So what? There's the word mukti right there. In, if you look at the previous purport to text 35, two or three lines up, you see that? Muktir hitvanyata rupam. You see that? So this is one of the subject matters of the Bhagavatam, is mukti itself. But here's, see what it says, what is the definition of mukti? It's giving a little definition here. It means giving up all of the false forms that we have, namely these bodily forms, and being situated, vyavastiti, in our swarup. We all have our swarup, our own personal form, unique, which is exactly suitable for serving Krishna in a certain kind of way. Maybe a coward boy, maybe a coward girl, maybe a cow, you know? Doesn't matter, you're fully conscious. Fully conscious of Krishna. But the idea is that that's our form, our eternal form. And now this is our false form. Like it's false ego. The false form goes with the false ego. Right? It's not us. We think it is. That's our problem. So there's nothing wrong with mukti in the context of bhakti. And that's exactly what Lord Chaitanya told him. So we should aspire for that kind of mukti. You know, remember one of the elements of knowledge was janma mrityu jara vyadi dukkha doshana darshanam. Means seeing. It's like we get darshan. Darshan means to see and be seen. See the deity and be seen by the deity. That's darshan. People want to take darshan. You know. Well, the deity is taking darshan of you also. So anyway, but here's the anudarshanam, to see carefully the dosha, the fault, the evils of birth, old age, disease, and death. I like to do them in that order because that's the order you're experiencing them. Birth. Then, you know, you have a period of health, but then old age, disease, and death. That's the cycle. So it's not a good thing. You know, practically speaking, most of life is denying these things. People do all these things to put themselves in denial. I was just thinking today about how You know, I don't know how, about you, but in my lifetime, at a certain point, you get pretty sick. Say you get the flu or something, or even you have to go to the hospital, right? Something happens, and you're laid up. Now, I know in my own experience, when that happens, so many other things that you were involved in and were important are just out the window. You're not interested. A lot of times you can't eat. You don't have an appetite. That's one thing that goes. Something which is like so central, you know, eating, you're not interested anymore. You're sick, you know. And all kinds of relationships, you know, nothing is of interest. The only thing that you're interested in is getting better. That's the paramount thing, right? And then all of us obviously did get better if we went through something like that, and here we are, you know, healthy, pretty much healthy life, you know. And then you know, with the strength of the senses returns and your life air kind of, oh, now you're interested in all these other things that you left off, isn't it? So now, you know, project. Now we're at the final, you know, 6 months or whatever it is of our life in this body. So many things are falling away. They're not important anymore. And if we're Krishna conscious, we know that, you know, okay, I reconcile, I'm not going to get better, you know. Or if it doesn't matter. What's really important is the state of my consciousness. Not that it's going to be completely absorbed in this body, and then how depressing that is. I'm sick. I'm dying. I'm finished. That's bodily concept of life. A devotee realizes that, okay, now's the time to, with the help of my God brothers, God sisters, if it's a woman, you know, to be Krishna conscious, because you have to leave this body. You see how everything, it's all tied in with the body. And the body is sick, and the senses are sick. You can't do what you used to do. All of those things that were so important become unimportant. Just like I was looking at this fellow, Steve Jobs, who just died, you know. And you could see, I mean, years ago, you could see he's dying. You know, he lost all that weight. He had the liver problem, right? Okay, but why is he wasting his time with his stupid Apple gadgets? Because that's all he knows, you know. That's his life. Come on, you know, you got the warning there. You're obviously dying. Chant Hare Krishna. Go and find those devotees you knew back in, you know, when you were a kid and you walked. You know, there's this famous commencement address he gave in Stanford in 2005. He was telling about his life. When he was just a kid, he dropped out of Stanford, I think it was, and he just started taking classes, you know, auditing classes. He had no money. He would walk across town to the Hare Krishna temple to get one good meal a week. He said 7 miles. He said, Hare Krishna. So all those people, famous. But something, you know, it didn't take, you know. He didn't realize this is more important than all of the other stuff. And then at the end, the fag end of life, he couldn't, you know, recapture the Hare Krishna. You know, that wasn't important to him. We tried to reach him. When he gave that address in 2005, since that time, which was 6 years ago, the devotees were trying to, you know, okay, come, you know, come on back. You know, can we talk to you? No, he doesn't want to talk to you guys, you know. What a fool. I don't care how many, you know, gadgets he made. It's unbelievable. They're adulating him like he's some kind of a saint or a pioneer or like, you know. It's just a tragic waste, you see. So knowledge, you know, means an element of knowledge, important knowledge, seeing the birth, old age, disease, and death. And what are we going to do about it? But we want to get out of it. Okay, well, that's what we need this knowledge for. Get on the boat of transcendental knowledge. Act on that knowledge, and we can cross over this ocean. Any questions on this? Even if you're this most sinful of all sinners, that's very encouraging for us. I know I was pretty much in that category at one point. All right, here we go now with the fire. Yatayadangsi samidhognir. Basmasat kuruterjuna. Gyanagni sarvakarmani basmasat kurute tatha. As a blazing fire turns firewood to ashes, O Arjuna, so does the fire of knowledge burn to ashes all reactions to material activities. Purport. Perfect knowledge of self and super-self and of their relationship is compared to fire. This fire not only burns up all reactions to impious activities, but also all reactions to pious activities, turning them to ashes. There are many stages of reaction in the making, reaction fructifying, reaction already achieved, and reaction a priori. But knowledge of the constitutional position of the living entity burns everything to ashes. When one is in complete knowledge, all reactions, both a priori and a posteriori, are consumed. In the Vedas, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad 4.4.22, it is stated, Uhai Vaisha Ete Tarat Amita Sadhuni. One overcomes both the pious and impious reactions of work. So, the knowledge as a boat is a way of avoiding, you know, in a boat you avoid getting wet, right? And you can go on top of the water. So if we're in an ocean and it's an ocean of sinful reactions, we can avoid them. But here, knowledge is acting as a fire to burn them up. In other words, it's more direct action. So it's basically the same idea. Is that, remember I mentioned the seeds, right? So when you sin, you plant a seed of the reaction and also of doing it again. So now if you take a seed, it can stay in a dry place for years, decades, hundreds of years. And then if it's properly preserved, you can plant it and it'll fructify. Right? They've taken seeds out of Egyptian pyramids and planted them. But if you burn the seeds, or if you heat the seeds enough, they won't fructify no matter what you do. So that's why this fire is there. You burn the seeds of sinful reaction. Now, we all have all these seeds. You know, in a sense, this seed analogy is very telling. Krishna talks about planting the seed of devotion. Right? The seed of the creeper of devotion. Bhakti lata bija. Bija means seed. So that's a good seed. The seed fructifies into desire. And desire, you know, fructifies into activity. This is how we live our lives. Someone, you hear something, you know. I don't know why, but I'm thinking of the Gold Rush, California Gold Rush. Was it 1850 or so? You know. So what happened? Somebody in New York read a newspaper, or somebody told them, there's gold in California. I want the gold, right? So it plants a strong desire seed. Activity is there. Get on the wagon train or the railroad, you know, go across a lot of hardship. All, you know, thousands, thousands went, a few made some gold. The guys who were selling the equipment to mine the gold, they made the real money, you know. But the point is, you hear or you read or somehow or other, the perception is there, plants a desire seed and you act. So these seeds are being planted all the time. You know, we're like the mind is scanning, you know, through the senses. Where's the pleasure? Where's the pleasure? Where's something good? You know, where's the safety? You know, in other words, and if the seed is planted, and if you feel, I can do that, I can accomplish that, then you act on it. So similarly, by the mercy of the Guru and Krishna, the seed of devotion is planted. It's like we hear these things, right? Now these books are going out by the thousands. Almost 500 million literatures have been distributed since Prabhupada landed in America. 500 million. You know, some of them pamphlets, some of them this, some of them back together magazine, some of them Bhagavad Gitas, you know. But there's still only really a few thousand of us full-time devotees. There's many who are some interested. You know, Krishna consciousness is known. There's so many levels of commitment. But the seed to be planted and then to fructify needs careful tending. And that's why these ashrams are meant for that. It's just like a garden. The ashram is just like a garden. Garden is a place where you can tend to plants with great focus and intensity. Pull out the weeds, proper nourishment, proper water. Make sure the sun is just right, not too much, not too little. Right? So similarly, ashram is like that. And what is the chief watering process? Hearing and chanting. That's the chief watering process. And at the same time, we have to be careful of the weeds, which are the aparads. Those are the offenses. Nam aparad, Vaishnav aparad, Dham aparad, Seva aparad. There's all different offenses. You know, offenses to the holy Dham, offenses to the deity, but especially offenses to the name and offenses to the Vaishnavs. So we have to know what they are, just like you have to know what the laws are in order to avoid them. you know, you ride on the right side of the road. You want to know what it is. So we have to know what they are so we can avoid them. And at the same time, we should know what those good things are. You know, what the holy name is, what proper things are to do. And in this way, we cultivate that the seed of bhakti. And meanwhile, by the process of bhakti, the seeds of material desire are being burned up. They're being, you know, fried. I gave the example, you know, of meat eating. I mean, that's kind of an easy one to fry, you know. At least pretty, you know, as soon as you taste prasadam, chant Lord Hare Krishna, and you read about the cow and how dear the cow is to Krishna, and hey, you know, it becomes abominable. Something which you thought wouldn't think twice about, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, whenever it was, or a month ago. You give up the desire. The desire isn't even there anymore, you know, generally speaking. So that same detachment and even revulsion can be there for all kinds of sense gratification if we cultivate Krishna consciousness nicely. And that's part of what it means to be in the fire of knowledge. It burns up all of this karma. And Prabhupada makes the point, it's also good karma. You know, there's no such thing really as good material karma. Because even if you do a good thing, you know, suppose you start a school or you help somebody on the material platform, well, you got it coming back to you. Just like you can't avoid the sinful reactions, you can't avoid the pious reactions. Fine, I started a school, so in my next life I'll get a good education. But I still have to be in the next life. I got to be born. I got to go through birth and old age, disease, and death again to receive my result of my good karma. So you see, it's not really good because it keeps you bound to birth and death. So that's why it said, you know, even the second chapter, buddhi yukto jahatiha ubhe sukrita dushkrite. If one is situated in buddhi yoga jahatiha, one gives up both ube, sukrita and dushkrita. Sukrita is good karmic reactions. Dushkrita is bad karmic reactions. You give them both up. We want to be free of we don't care about good karma. The only karma we want is that karma or activity that produces devotional service. We don't want to get anything that requires us to stay, or do anything that requires us to stay in this material world to get the fruit, either bitter fruit or sweet fruit. That's the devotee's understanding. That's why Lord Chaitanya said, Nadanam Nadanam Nasundarim. I don't want wealth. I don't want beautiful women. I don't want to go to heaven. I don't want any of that stuff. You know, what do you want? Your devotional service. Ahoitiki. Without material motive. This is a prayer that we should follow. Any questions on this verse? How to get rid of both good and bad karma? Yeah.
Do all the seeds of material desires need to be burned up before the devotional creeper is planted?
No. The planting it takes place in the heart, could be in the heart of the greatest sinner. But then we have to tend the plant. There's a process, just like you may have heard of this process where first comes faith, then comes association, then comes practice, chanting. And then there is initiation, you know. And then by bhajan, a kriya, you get rid of the anartas, the unwanted things. So the creeper of devotion is growing, but it's competing with the other plants that are already there, strongly rooted. So it's a process of not feeding the other plants, you know, not feeding the other desire creepers, uprooting the weeds, like the aparads, and nicely feeding and tending the bhakti creeper. So it's not that, you know, that seed is planted and it's given out to everybody. Fortunate souls who are able to receive the seed and plant it in their heart and tend it, then that's what they're called Vaishnavas. But this, you know, the seeds are going out to everybody. So no, it's a question that's up to us how quickly we want, you know, and luxuriantly we want that creeper to grow. You know, nicely hearing and chanting and avoiding the bad things and uprooting the weeds. All right, one more. Nahi jnane sadrisham.
Nahi jnane sadrisham.
pavitram iha vidyate. Tat svayam yoga sangsiddha. Kalenatmanivindati. In this world, there is nothing so sublime and pure as transcendental knowledge. Such knowledge is the mature fruit of all mysticism. And one who has become accomplished in the practice of devotional service enjoys this knowledge within himself in due course of time. Purport. When we speak of transcendental knowledge, we do so in terms of spiritual understanding. As such, there is nothing so sublime and pure as transcendental knowledge. Ignorance is the cause of our bondage, and knowledge is the cause of our liberation. This knowledge is the mature fruit of devotional service, and when one is situated in transcendental knowledge, he need not search for peace elsewhere, for he enjoys peace within himself. In other words, this knowledge and peace culminate in Krishna consciousness. That is the last word in the Bhagavad Gita. So once again, you know, the essence of the knowledge is understanding that we are servants of Krishna. It may seem like a simple thing, but when we understand that knowledge means also acting on the basis of that knowledge. If you don't act on the basis of the knowledge, then you lose it, you forget it. And we've seen it practically. So that knowledge, I am a servant of Krishna, it's a direct challenge to the illusion that we're this body. You see the difference there. We are basing our actions on the knowledge, the illusion, which we take to be knowledge. Yes, that I am this person, this particular body, and I have so many identities or parties or designations, you know, on the top of this body. Oh, I'm a professor. I worked very hard for that degree. You know, it's got the plaque on the wall. There's my name and everything. That's part of my identity now. And it means I act in a certain way. I have a certain set of relationships. I pull down a certain salary commensurate with that, and that's who I am. You know, and it's, you know, total. It's a big, you know, self-perpetuating kind of cloud of illusion. And it gets completely punctured at the time of death. What happened? Where's the doctor? Where's the professorship? Where's the PhD? Where's my bank account? It's all lying on the bed there. You're going somewhere else. Suddenly you're stripped of that false identity, very shockingly, and you take on another one, gradually, 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 if you're taking a human form of life. You come out again, oh, now I'm Chinese. Now I'm a poor peasant. Now that's who I am. You see the problem there? So, knowledge of if you're knowledgeable that you're a servant of Krishna, and you act on that knowledge, then that takes you across the barrier of death. It stays with you. You don't, you know, it's not something that you lose at the time of death. So there's nothing as pure. Now the purity is mentioned here. This is. Again, the process of devotional service is a process of cleansing, cheto darpana marginam. All of this illusion is a kind of a dirt on the soul. That is dust on the mirror of the mind, and you can't see who you really are. But that's a wonderful thing. It means that we have that identity within us. It's not something that has to be brought out from outside. It just needs to be revealed. We just need to cleanse away the dirt, and the reality will be there. Nitya siddha Krishna prema sadhya kabunai. Shramanadi shuddha chitte kadayahi doi. The word shuddha means purify. That the eternal perfection of love of Krishna is there within the heart of everyone. It's not something artificial to be brought from the outside. You know. And just by the process of hearing and chanting, etc., the other process of devotion, the heart becomes purified and that love awakens. Along with that love is awakened our understanding of our swarup, our actual form. And so you can see that the knowledge is purifying. There's nothing as purifying as that knowledge. If we stick with it and act on that understanding of who we are, then that purification will take place. Yoga sangsiddha, complete perfection of yoga in devotion in this case. And in due course of time, we enjoy that. He says, kalinamanavindati, there's an enjoyment there of just, you know, living in your real identity. and, you know, and gradually discovering it. It's not something dry or boring or one-dimensional or, you know, superficial. But it's very deep. It's as, you know, as deep as anything deep can be. And there's an unlimited, you know, field of discovery in that level, in the level of consciousness and relationship with Krishna. You read the Nectar of Devotion. So many details of the different varieties of emotions in relation to Krishna, the rasas. You know, this is the night of the rasa dance. You know, we should say something about that. This is the night that, you know, the anniversary. You know, so of course the gopis are far beyond, you know, what we would only call knowledge. But hey, so many of the gopis, you know what their background is. It's described in the Krishna book in the 10th canto by the acharyas that there's actually four different groups of gopis in that rasa dance. There are Krishna's eternal, gopis from the spiritual world that he brings down with him. There are those who are being promoted to that level from the earth. It's actually another group. There's also the daughters of the demigods. There are the personified Vedas. Now, the personified Vedas are introduced in the 87th chapter. Each of the Upanishads is personified there. And they all offer prayers to Mahavishnu before the creation. They kind of wake him up, and when he opens his eyes, he glances at the Mahatattva, and out come all the living entities. We were among them last time, last creation. So these personified Vedas, some of them at least, are praying that they will be able to be just like the gopis, that they will get births and be able to serve Krishna like the gopis do. And that desire was fulfilled. So who could be more wise? Who could be more knowledgeable than the Vedas, the personified Vedas? You see. So there you get the jnana culminating in bhakti. You see? The end of jnana is bhakti. That's why Veda is another word for knowledge, and anta means the end, right? And bhakti means devotion. And you put it all together. What do you got? Bhakti Vedanta. Prabhupada's name. The end of knowledge is bhakti. So, and then another set of gopis, yet another set, is comprised of the sages from the Dandakaranya forest. When Lord Ram went into the forest with Sita and Lakshman, there were many sages meditating there. And then the demons would, you know, the Rakshasas would be harassing them, and Ram saved, you know, killed the Rakshasas and saved the sages. So when they saw Ram, they felt, oh, we want to serve you like the gopis did. We want to serve you in the, like Sita is serving you, the most intimate way, you know, like that. And Ram said, no, not in this incarnation. I only have one wife. You'll have to take birth as gopis in Vrindavan. Then you can meet me for the, you know, rasa dance. And they did. So here you have these gopis. Now in that birth, there's just simple coward girls, right? That's their qualification. I don't think I'm speculating here, but they don't remember that we were great sages. That would ruin the mood, you know. They're just identifying themselves as coward girls, you know. But their great qualification is that they love Krishna like no one else can love him. And they have bodies just suitable to give Krishna the greatest pleasure. We have to remember that when there's a question of service, the quality of the service is measured by how pleasing it is to the served, right? So Krishna says in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna's Kaviraj, he quotes him. He says, yes, I know. I like, you know, when people recognize me as Vishnu, as the Supreme Lord, and they offer oblations, that's very nice. But that doesn't please me at all, really, compared to the spontaneous loving devotion of these residents of Vrindavan who forget that I'm God. You know, who forget that I'm God and just worship, you know, serve me as Mother Yashoda, chastising me, binding me to the mortar. You know, that wins my heart more than these formal offerings, you see. And what to speak of his friends, playing with him, jumping on him, chastising him, joking, playing jokes on him, you know, forgetting that he's God. That pleases him more. And most pleasing, of course, is the gopis. And he says there that in this spontaneous, loving exchange that I have, I will also forget who I am. Yeah. That Yogamaya will take over and I will also be covered and forget that I'm God. So I can enjoy with these gopis as, this spontaneous devotion. But it's made very clear in the fourth chapter of Adi Lila that there's not a tinge of material lust there. That Krishna is appearing like he is and having these feelings just to please the gopis who want to serve him in such a way. In other words, they have to forget that he's God, and see him as their sweet, adolescent lover to serve him in the way they want to serve him. And they're dressing themselves and coming out to the forest and doing that just to please him. You see the difference? In the go down to the bars or, where they're dancing, the crazy. It's a perverted reflection. Okay? Perfect word, perverted reflection. But where is the selflessness there? Everybody is there dressed, they dress themselves up like they set up a scene. But there's a tremendous amount of selfishness there. Isn't it? They're all doing it so that I can enjoy. Just the opposite. All of this stuff is just, Krishna's doing it for the gopis are doing it for Krishna. There's not a tinge of lust there. So that's the perfection. And you can see the knowledge of these sages in Dandakaranya, the sages, the Vedas personified, culminates in this spontaneous devotion. So that's where it all leads. So the purification, nothing can be as pure as this love that the gopis feel. This unalloyed devotion. And, Krishna called them with the flute, and out they came, spontaneously. They couldn't restrain, nobody could restrain them. Well, they did, some of them, and they meditated on Krishna. And they enjoyed that rasa dance for the night of Brahma. And it just seemed to go like that. They were so sad that it went, time doesn't matter. On the spiritual plane, a million years can be like a second, and in separation from Krishna, a second could seem like a million years. It's all very mystical. And wonderful. On that note, we need to adjourn. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.